Mark chapter 1. As you know, right now we're not in a series of messages, and we're looking at a variety of passages and topics. And this morning my attention has been drawn to the first chapter of this great book of the New Testament, Mark chapter 1. In just a moment we'll be starting to look at this passage, beginning at verse 21. Mark chapter 1 and verse 21. If you were here last week, you know that we were considering very broad issues about God's work in the world and thinking about many of the problems that are going on an international level. And I'm not going to be dealing with that topic today, but I do want to bring it back to the surface to get us started. That's because when you think about some of these things that are going on in the Middle East, this is very much of a polarizing situation. You end up having to take sides because the positions that are stated are so strong and so opposing to each other. It's a little hard to be ambivalent about what is going on. We have seen an example of that this past week, because you had, first of all, on Wednesday, the leader of the country of Iran give a speech in the United Nations where essentially he blamed the world's problems on some of the Western countries in the world, and including in that whole package also the state of Israel. The very next day, the Prime Minister of Israel spoke to the United Nations and more or less said that Iran was the great threat to the countries of the world and to Israel in particular. Some figures in history and some figures in the current scene call forth a response. It is difficult in a situation like that to be ambivalent, to just kind of shrug your shoulders and say, whatever, because of the nature of the claims that these leaders are making. And I want to suggest to you that Jesus Christ is that same kind of figure, that it is impossible to be ambivalent toward him because of the nature of the claims that he makes. And those who have a sort of half-hearted response to him, they really need to be exposed as having a position that is indefensible. Those are the sorts of ideas that come to the surface as we deal with this first chapter of Mark. This gospel has begun in very rapid-fire fashion to introduce the Lord Jesus Christ. In verses 1 to 8, we read about John the Baptist preparing the way for him. As you come to verse 9 and through verse 11, you read about the baptism of Jesus himself that kind of formally initiated his public ministry. He engages in a battle against Satan and triumphs over Satan's temptation in verses 12 to 13. And in verses 14 and 15, you have a little summary of the message that he preached. How can you be ambivalent toward this? The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. That is a dogmatic claim that calls for a definite response. And the Lord made an appeal about that to a few men in verses 16 to 20. We read there about the initial call of some of his disciples. And now that the foundation is laid, and now that the pieces are in place for him to begin reaching out more broadly among the people of Israel, his ministry begins in full as we come to verse 21. We read here, starting in verse 21, some selected details toward the beginning of Jesus' ministry. A number of them that occurred within one day. So on a particular Sabbath, as he is in Capernaum at the synagogue, he is teaching, and in the course of that meeting, he expels a demon from a man. He heals Peter's mother-in-law in verses 29 to 31, and that evening, there are many people who are as well delivered from the oppression of Satan, verses 32 to 34. The next day, he moves beyond Capernaum, and he starts to minister throughout the region of Galilee, And his ministry is going to include the healing of a leper at verses 40 to 45. So you see there a number of short stories, these little vignettes about the ministry of Christ getting started. And if you ask, what brings all of these things together? How are these things actually united in communicating one idea? You really would have to conclude that these, in one way or another, are highlighting the authority of Jesus Christ. They are backing up what he had said regarding the kingdom of God being present in him. They are illustrating some of the dimensions of his authority and demonstrating that he is indeed who he says that he is, that he indeed does embody the rule of God over the world. This is stated explicitly, if you look with me briefly, at verse 22. It says that the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. It is stated as well down in verse 27, when those same people say, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And even when the word authority doesn't show up, what else could you conclude as you read these different incidents? For example, if you look down at verse 32, it speaks of these people who were sick or oppressed with demons. And verse 34, many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, the number of miracles that he performed, the variety of problems that he addressed, demonstrating the extent of his authority over these different realms of life. And Mark is going to continue making that point about the authority of Jesus as you read on. In chapter 2, he has the authority to forgive sins. In chapter 3 and again in chapter 6, he takes of his authority over demons and actually gives that same authority to his disciples. In chapter 11, he demonstrates, he claims authority to cleanse the temple as the one who actually rules over even the place of worship. The point is that there is no force that is able to successfully oppose Jesus Christ. He is claiming and he is demonstrating that he is the ruler over all. But when you look at these opening stories, you find that Jesus is not the only figure who is under discussion. It's because these stories are recounting particular interactions that he has with other people. It is Jesus and it is somebody else on the other side, or some group of people on the other side. And there's interaction and there's conversation and there's back and forth. There is, in those interactions, really the theme of the passage, more specifically, as well the application for our lives. What becomes apparent is that every individual who is interacting with Jesus in some way, that individual has to respond to Jesus' authority. That individual has to make some kind of response based upon who Jesus is saying that he is. And when you put all these together, you realize that these responses that are illustrated here are not limited to these original people, because in fact, in our day and in our own lives, we may respond to Jesus in any number of ways, some of which are inappropriate, and some of which do not correspond to the kinds of claims that he is making. And so this morning I'd like to consider this passage under this theme, responding to the authority of Jesus Christ. Responding to the authority of Jesus Christ. You find reflected in these stories five possibilities as to how people respond to Christ. The first of those, in the first passage, has to do with the way in which the people at the synagogue responded to Jesus. And let's look at that again. If you go with me to verse 21, I'll read down to verse 28. It says, "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. I don't think it's too hard to see that as it relates to the people in the synagogue, the people there listening to the teaching and observing this miracle, their response can be summarized with the word amazement. That is one response we can make to Jesus Christ. It is to be amazed at him. And there are actually two words in the text that make this point. In verse 22, it says that they were astonished. We know that this is something significant for Mark, that he's attempting to make a point here, because actually four other times in the gospel, this word is used to speak of people's response to Christ. So the word astonished here, that means to be struck with amazement. We might be able to describe it this way. This is our language for it, that somebody is blown away. They are feeling as though somebody had hit them. It just has affected them with such surprise. And it's so unexpected. The word amazed is used down in verse 27. That one occurs two other times in the Gospel of Mark. And it means to marvel at, to stand in wonder of something that is beyond your ability to explain, and something that's totally beyond your range of experience. Now these are fine responses. You and I should be blown away when we read of these miracles that Jesus did. The problem is that it is possible to be amazed and yet to lack true faith. You may be amazed at Christ and yet not really be submitted to him as your king. And this becomes clear when you look at some of the other places in Mark when people have this kind of response to Jesus. Let me show them to you. If you go with me to Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6. And take a look at verse 2 and then verse 3. Mark 6, starting at verse 2. Here again it says, "On the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, 'Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands?'" And those are not bad questions. Those questions, you really would be hard-pressed to say what they're showing about people's heart. They might be curious, they might really desire more information, so they might follow Christ. But then look at what it says in verse 3. "Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" In other words, at that point they're beginning to say, how can this be? How can he really come from God? How can we follow him when we know that he has very humble origins, like the rest of it? The rest of us, he's nothing different, he is nothing special. And it says that they took offense at him. And Jesus ends up having to say about these, the people from his own hometown, that a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown. In other words, to be amazed at Jesus, to be impressed with his message, to be impressed with his power, doesn't really indicate what is the true condition of your heart. It doesn't indicate you have an appropriate relationship with him. And in fact, as it relates to the disciples themselves, let's jump to chapter 10, a chapter we're going to have to mention a little bit later on. But they have received at this point some hints about the direction that Jesus' ministry is taking. And Jesus is heading to Jerusalem for the final experiences of his life that will bring about his crucifixion. And it says in verse 32 that they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed. There it is again. And those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, and discusses very specifically his upcoming death. You become aware that as you read the passage, these disciples are struggling with all manner of things that are inappropriate in their relationship to Christ. Even though they were amazed, that didn't cover the full response that you ought to have to Jesus Christ. Being impressed with him is not enough. Our world today is filled with people who say they respect Jesus, who honor his memory in lovely terms, who don't have a problem viewing him as a significant figure in history, and who even claim that they are attempting to follow some of his teachings, viewing him as a great teacher of morality. But let's realize that those responses, as positive as they may sound, are not adequate for the kind of authority that Jesus is claiming for himself. He didn't come into the world to be recognized as a great teacher of morality or somebody significant in history who taught us some good things. And ultimately, it is an insult to recognize Jesus in those ways if you don't actually yield to him in keeping with what he said about himself. And what he said about himself was that he is the only mediator between God and man. He claimed that, in fact, he was bringing God's rule to earth, and that all men were bound to yield to him and to his work and to his gospel. To be impressed with him is one of those inadequate responses. Now, as we look again at this passage back in Mark chapter 1, there is somebody else interacting with Jesus there in the synagogue. The people are observing, the people are responding, but there's another figure. Actually, he is not a human being. He is a spirit being that is interacting with Christ through a human that he has possessed. And what sort of response does this demon indicate toward Jesus? Again, it's not too hard to figure out. The text says that this unclean spirit cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." This little story about the demon-possessed man, as Mark tends to do, he sandwiches it in between the story of the people and their response. In other words, these things all go together. These things help to interpret each other. And what is it that the demon is doing here? The Bible doesn't record too many conversations between the Lord and the forces of evil. And yet in this case, when you look at the words that came out of the mouth of this demon-possessed man, they're actually pretty good theology. They really are. Verse 24, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth?" He basically is putting a distinction between himself and Christ. He is saying that we don't belong in the same category. We should not be in the same place here in some way in touch with each other. We represent totally different kingdoms, totally different values. You don't have anything to do with us. And then he says, "Have you come to destroy us?" Well, later on in the New Testament, we read this verse, 1 John 3:8, "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil." And then the demon says, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And one of the great differences between the devil and Satan is the matter of moral purity, which he's getting at when he describes Jesus as the Holy One of God. He recognized that there was an incompatible difference between them, that he represented uncleanness and rebellion against God. Jesus represented purity and submission to God. And this makes this devil terribly uncomfortable with conviction. And there's another detail here that indicates the kind of response, because both at verse 23 and at verse 26, it says that this demon cried out, or he cried out with a loud voice. What is his response? You could describe it perhaps with the word fright. He's not just impressed like the people, but he has actually more understanding than they do, so much that he is, to a certain extent, afraid of Christ. He wants to get away from him. He doesn't want to have anything to do with him. So he makes some pretty good theological statements about his own identity and about the identity of Christ. But what is it that is lacking in those statements? Here's some of the things that are lacking. You don't see any sorrow for sin. You don't see any reliance on Christ. You certainly don't see any submission to him. Actually, what you see is resistance to the authority of Jesus. He's afraid of the Lord, but he is attempting to stand against him, and the Lord finally has to forcibly cast him out. There is that resistance to the bitter end. Now, that's a pretty extreme response, and I'm not aware that there are any people exactly like this individual in this room as we're talking about these things. But sadly, many people in the world do end up responding to Jesus in the same way that this demon does. They have some level of understanding of who Christ is. They have some sense of their guilt before him, and perhaps even some understanding of the gospel that provides a way by which that guilt may be forgiven, but their heart is not broken. Their attitude towards sin is not changed. Their fright has not translated itself into actual humility before the authority of Jesus Christ. And you remember what James said. He says, "Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. You realize there is a kind of demonic faith that may characterize certain individuals. It is a faith in the mind and even a faith in the emotions. But it is not a saving faith, because it does not lead the individual to actually submit to the authority of Jesus Christ. And someday, people in that category are going to have the same experience as this demon. They are going to be compelled to bow the knee and to confess Jesus as Lord, but at that point it will be too late for that confession to do them any good. And even though we're reading about a demon, the Bible teaches us that that same response may characterize human beings as well. And in this we should be warned about the danger of responding to Christ in a way that doesn't lead to actual repentance and faith. Now we move on to the next little story here. And this one is the bright spot. It doesn't say a great deal, it's fairly short, but it's the little story about the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. It says at verse 29 that immediately Jesus left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand, and lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That is the shortest healing story in Mark. I believe Mark, in keeping with the rest of his gospel, is a master of understatement here. We don't want to miss that the point that he is making by the brevity of this story and how it is actually setting up the theme of this whole gospel. We don't know much about this woman. We don't know what she was sick with. What we do know is that Jesus healed her without medicine, without struggle, without difficulty. He did it immediately, and there was an immediate response back to the one that had done the healing. And that response is described with the verb serve. Here again, we find that Mark is introducing something that's going to become very important later in his gospel. In fact, the idea of service is at the very heart of the gospel of Mark. The verb serve, there in verse 31, occurs in a number of other places. Let me read to you a couple of verses here. Actually, this one is before what we have just run across. It speaks of Jesus being in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild animals. And here are the kind of figures that this woman is sort of associating with because of her service. It says there that in the wilderness, the angels were ministering to Christ or serving him. In chapter 15, much later, verse 41, we find out about some women who were observing the crucifixion. And it says about them that when he was in Galilee, they followed him and ministered to him or served him. And there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. You've got the angels at the beginning serving Christ. You've got these women at the end who are described as servants of Christ. And what is the key verse of this whole gospel? The one that presents to us the theme of Mark, which is a paradox. It is the paradox between the divine authority of Jesus Christ and the fact that even though he was God's appointed ruler over everything, he came to be a servant. And maybe you could quote Mark chapter 10 and verse 45, the theme verse of this book. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and specifically to give his life as a ransom for many. You also find some important usages of the noun servant, particularly when Jesus is telling his own disciples about this part of their lives. He says, for example, in chapter 9, verse 35, as he's speaking to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all, and servant of all. And in chapter 10, verse 43, he says, they are not to be among, like the Gentiles in terms of all about position and abusing people that are under you and just pursuing positions of authority. But he says, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. In the Gospel of Mark, the proof that your faith is genuine, the evidence that you have from your heart had the right response to Christ, is that you take the position of a servant, just like he did to get all of this started in the first place. At the heart of your relationship to Christ is that simple faith that says Jesus is who he claimed to be, and his work on the cross is the only thing that will deliver me from the wrath of God. But along with that, Mark is making the point that if faith is genuine, what it inevitably produces is an attitude of servanthood toward Christ. That instead of thinking you rule your own life Instead of living as though you were your own king, you assume the posture of a subject under the authority of the one who has first served you, and you live your life with that attitude. And this, I believe, is what we find just foreshadowed from a literary standpoint as Mark tells us about the response of Peter's mother-in-law. She began to serve him and his disciples. Now, one of the sad things in this chapter and in Mark as a whole is that of the people that you would have expected to have understood all that I just said, they were some of the ones that struggled with it the most. And I'm talking here about the disciples of Jesus himself. This passage deals with them too, and actually at this point, they're not giving an appropriate response to Christ. He had introduced them, some of them, back in verses 16 to 20. And at that point, Simon, Andrew, James, and John immediately left what they were doing and became followers of Christ. That was certainly a right response to his authority. But they're going to struggle with that at various points. And they're going to even challenge the Lord. And their thinking is going to have to be corrected as to what the life of the disciple is like. And that, again, in a subtle way, comes up as you look at what happens starting in verse 32. That evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. And the whole city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him. And they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next town, that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. This is the first time of several in this book that there's a bit of tension between Jesus and his disciples about the shape that Jesus' ministry ought to take. Here again, Mark is gradually introducing an issue that is going to grow as you read on in this book. Initially, it's a little hard to know what Peter or Simon is getting at or how to interpret his words to Christ. But I'm going to share with you some significant facts about the terminology that is used here out of Peter's mouth and in his response. It says, first of all, in verse 36, that those who were with him searched for Christ. That word search seems kind of general. It seems kind of normal to us in English, but in fact in the original language it's a fairly strong word. It means to track down. It could also be translated to hunt somebody down, as in you're very intense to find them. And it is not entirely clear what your motive is when you're tracking him down. And then when Peter talks in verse 37, he says, "Everyone is looking for you." There again is a verb that probably is better translated to seek out Jesus. And I'll read you what one commentator says about this particular verb, especially as it's used in the Gospel of Mark. He says it occurs 10 times in Mark, and in each instance it carries negative connotations. Its first 2 occurrences refer to interference of Jesus and obstruction to ministry. Its next 2 refer to disbelief and faithlessness, and the remaining occurrences refer to people seeking out Jesus to kill him a number of times there toward the end of the book. This idea of seeking in this gospel connotes an attempt to determine and control rather than to submit and follow. In this respect, to seek for Jesus is not a virtue in the Gospel of Mark, nor are clamoring crowds a sign of success or an aid to ministry. Here, as elsewhere in Mark, enthusiasm is not to be confused with faith. Indeed, it can oppose faith. In other words, These guys were all excited about the immediate response. They're hunting Jesus down. Other people are searching Jesus and looking for him and desiring to hear from him. But it is implied and also becomes clear as you read on in Mark that their motives for desiring Jesus are not entirely appropriate. Another commentator says this, here Mark, particularly with the terminology, indicated the error of the disciples. They wanted Jesus to take advantage of his growing popularity and perform more miracles. However, Jesus' primary mission was not to be a miracle worker, but a redeemer. He says, I came out to preach. The disciples failed to understand that the popularity itself made Jesus want to withdraw. The people of Capernaum apparently had no interest in Jesus beyond his miracles or any interest in coming under the reign of God. Verse 37 is the first instance in Mark where the disciples failed to understand the mission of Jesus. And there would be many other occasions in which they would misunderstand, culminating in that chapter 10. Do you remember what it was that led Jesus to talk so much there about you've got to be a servant. I came to be a servant. What was the issue? Why was he rebuking the disciples in that chapter? It was because they were arguing over who would sit on his right and on his left in the kingdom. Even at that late date, like a few days before the crucifixion, they didn't get it. That this wasn't about amassing huge numbers of people and becoming famous, and getting a following, and getting positions of influence and authority over people. They still didn't get it. And this problem of ambition begins to display itself here at the outset in chapter 1. That would be another inadequate response to Christ. It really is tempting for any of us to come to Jesus for what we can get out of it personally, and begin to view Christ as though he were some kind of a good luck charm or just the key to my personal dreams. Mark is saying again and again, Jesus came to serve, but Jesus is king. The definition of your place and your purpose in life is determined by him. He is the one in the position of authority. We exist for him, and it is only as we are following him that we will understand what our true needs are and find them to be met in him. Even as true disciples, sometimes our vision becomes clouded. And Mark again and again is trying to expose the disciples' self-orientation so that other disciples would be warned that that is an inappropriate response to the authority of Christ. Now, there's one other story here, and you find a different response as well, looking at verse 40. And a leper came to him, imploring him, and kneeling said to him, if you will, you can make me clean. Moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I will. Be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him, and he was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent away at once and said to him, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priests and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them. But he went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news, so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town that was out in desolate places and people were coming to him from every quarter. Your heart goes out to this guy, to this leper. But the reality is that he presents to Jesus' authority a mixed response that confuses us. On the one hand, he shows humility and he says, if you will, you can make me clean. He's not demanding. He's requesting, taking a position of submission. And the Lord responds to that. I mean, he receives not just the power of God, but these statements about the compassion of Jesus, right? You see that? The Lord took pity on him. Verse 41, he was moved with pity, and he didn't just say, be healed. He actually touched the guy. Which would have been a problem for that society, because to touch somebody with leprosy would make you unclean. Jesus was willing to do that. This is the degree to which he wanted to demonstrate his compassion on this individual. And you would think that somebody who had experienced that, that would just lead to more humility on his part. And yet Jesus issued a warning to him. In fact, the wording of verse 43 is very strong. He sternly charged him. That refers to an emotion-laden, almost scolding. It sounds like Jesus is angry with him. He says, don't tell anybody about this. Go directly to the priest for cleansing. Now, why would Jesus say that? This whole idea of this work of the Messiah at this point being kept secret is actually repeated about a dozen times in various ways in Mark. Jesus does not want the crowds to get overly excited ahead of time. He does not want to be distracted by people overemphasizing his role as a healer. That's not the main reason he came. He is waiting for the hour that he actually came into the world to accomplish, and that would be his death on the cross. And so there are many times when he says, people, just quietly go, do what you're supposed to do, delight in what I've done with you, but do not spread this around. It's going to have a negative effect on what I'm actually working to do. Now again, your heart goes out to this guy. Understandably, he's excited. You would want to say to others as well, share with them what happened. But this was direct disobedience to a very clear command, very strong warning that Jesus gave him. And as Jesus anticipated, it ended up creating trouble for him, which is what the last verse says. He could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places. How does that strike you? What sort of response do you find illustrated there? I put it in these terms, that this was incomplete submission. This was a partial submission. That at a very difficult point, when the Lord's will crosses his, he fails to follow through. That reflects ingratitude. Ultimately, it's another form of insult. I mean, even a kind of betrayal that ends up creating further difficulties for Jesus. And we find a warning here about what a mixed bag the human heart is. That even somebody who's a genuine believer can go from a moment of humble worship, like we're trying to do here this morning, to betraying the Lord with disobedience to clear commandments. It's very helpful to see this problem exposed in this leper so that we will examine our own lives. What are the various responses to Jesus' authority? Here they are. Amazement, fright, humble service, ambition, incomplete submission. I believe the Lord would have us, through Mark, just ask ourselves the simple question today, how am I responding to Christ? Particularly at the point where his will crosses mine. Particularly at the point where he's calling me to some form of service and humility that is difficult for me. And somebody says, I'd probably fall in some of those other categories right now, not humble service. What would be the solution to all that? Well, I want to suggest that the key is not to beat ourselves up over our failures. There needs to be confession. There needs to be repentance. But what will ultimately move our hearts, folks, to make the kind of humble response that this passage is calling for, what will ultimately move our hearts, is to behold afresh who we're talking about. is to get a new vision of this Jesus whose name is on our lips so much. Who is He? He is God who became a man and died to serve us, to give Himself as a payment to rescue us from our own sin, so that we might be brought back under the joy that we were created for, which was to be arranged under the rule of God. And this gospel is working to reveal the glory of Jesus Christ in all the authority and yet the servanthood all meshed together in this beautiful paradox, that our hearts might be warmed to Him and our hearts might become yielded to Him. May the Lord give us a fresh vision of Christ.